From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Over 2 days this week, 20 candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination battled it out on stage in Detroit, Michigan, in a debate sponsored by CNN. On day one, progressive frontrunners Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren successfully fought off reformists' ideas on health care and other issues. On the second day, the top two moderate frontrunners, Kamala Harris and Joe Biden, had a rematch after clashing weeks ago in the first debate. CNN came under fire for echoing Republican talking points. Although Sanders and Warren appeared the winners to progressives, the corporate media appeared to remain invested in Joe Biden and some of the other moderate candidates. Today, we'll ask a longtime election analyst and stalwart progressive what lessons he drew from the debates. John Nichols is the national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine, host of their new podcast, Next Left, which features interviews with rising progressive politicians who explain how they plan to change the country. He's a contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times, an associate editor of The Capital Times. He's the author of numerous books, including Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, A Field Guide to the Most Dangerous People in America, and The Genius of Impeachment. Welcome to the program, John.
It is a great pleasure to be with you, my friend.
Thanks so much for joining us. So it was really interesting to see these two debates over 2 days. For me, initially, you know, sort of frustrating that a lot of the moderates kept pushing back against the progressive ideals that were mentioned. But then I remembered a time when not a single progressive idea ever made it onto the floor of a debate. And we would talk about why third parties weren't allowed because the Democratic Party would just never allow progressive voices. And I think we'd sort of forgotten about that.
Yeah, it was so bad that now it doesn't seem so bad. And that's an important thing, Sonali, to begin with. What we need to understand is this, and I won't go into a long history here, but I can just tell you that in the 1940s, at the end of Franklin Roosevelt's presidency, the Democratic Party had a choice to make, whether it would continue to be a transformational party, which for better or worse, not always perfect, but under Roosevelt it had tried to be, or whether it would become more of a status quo, mainstream, sort of left wing of the middle party. It chose the latter route. And truthfully, except for some rare occasions, and you can point to them, George McGovern in 72, and Jesse Jackson in 88, and to some extent in 84, the party has really closed out a lot of the left. And left-wing candidates may run, but they were very marginalized, usually from the beginning. This year is different. And it doesn't mean that a lot of the media and political elites wouldn't prefer to close out the left. But so much has changed in the country, and so much has changed even within the party, that they can't do that. And so you had this remarkable dynamic on the first night of debates, where you had a Democratic socialist and a Democratic capitalist. And that's this is the distinction here between Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. They aren't the same, but each of them speaks for a section of the left within the party. And they share many, many positions. They could actually have a good debate, by the way. They could disagree with one another on quite a few things. But on balance, they are to the left of the rest of the major candidates. So in this first debate, it was very clear that some of the centrist candidates, as well as, frankly, I think the moderators, really wanted to put Sanders and Warren into a corner. Instead of getting put in a corner, Sanders and Warren, both very, very skilled political figures, really kind of circled around the whole thing, took charge of it, dominated it by any measure. In fact, I would argue they dominated the first debate to such an extent and so effectively that they actually dominated the second debate.
Right. Bernie Sanders was mentioned a few times in the second day, even though he wasn't present.
Oh, yeah. And at one point, Jake Tapper read a long quote from Elizabeth Warren and asked Biden to respond to it. And so this was a very different dynamic, and, you know, from the past, because usually you know, you take your progressive candidates and just forget about them in a second debate. In this case, they came into it again and again in references from the candidates and the moderators. Now, the problem was, and I'll focus on this just for a second, when Jake Tapper read that quote from Elizabeth Warren, which was really about compromising the party and being too centrist, and perhaps as a result, harming the party's chances to mobilize people in November 2020, Biden didn't answer it. In fact, he danced around it and answered another part, an earlier part of a question from Tapper. And Tapper did not follow up on it. So you didn't have what I think we all would like to see, which is a debate in which Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are on the same stage with Kamala Harris and Joe Biden.
Right. And on this issue of people not answering the questions, I think that happens several times across both days. When asked direct pointed questions, a lot of the candidates didn't answer them. And the moderators, you know, and that's your job. It's your politician. You redirect to what you really want to say. But it's the job of the moderators to come back and say, you didn't answer my question. You know, yes or no. They did that a couple of times, but not enough. Now, it seemed to me one of the things, and I don't know if you noticed this, John, but it seemed to me that at least on day two of the debates, the smartest people in the room were the audience. Not only did you have several people shout very important things, such as fire Pantaleo to Bill de Blasio, to fire Daniel Pantaleo, the officer who killed Eric Garner, but also challenging Biden on the deportation machine under Obama. And I also noticed that they clapped most loudly when the most progressive issues were spelled out.
Absolutely. In fact, here's a really interesting thing, because our media doesn't even want to acknowledge what happens in front of it. And this is a bizarre thing. We're now a day or so after the debates, and so you have all this kind of rolling post-debate analysis. And you've heard a lot of elite media folks saying, oh, there was a very bad thing that happened in the second debate. Some people criticized Barack Obama. And they referenced Cory Booker at one point, making some distinctions on some things that perhaps the Obama-Biden administration didn't do so well. That's a logical thing to do in a debate. And yet there was a suggestion by a lot of the media folks after the debate, oh, Democrats aren't going to like that. They're going to be very angry with that. Wrong. In the debate, when Cory Booker said to Joe Biden, you can't have it both ways. You can't, always attach yourself to Barack Obama, but then when there's a criticism of Barack Obama, say, oh, I wasn't a part of that, right? And the crowd applauded like crazy.
Yeah.
Because, this is the thing. Obama was a very good president in many, many ways. But like every president, right, some more than others, he wasn't perfect. There were things that were flawed in his administration. I think it's not hard to point to him. You have done so well on this show, and many other folks have. And Democrats, grassroots Democrats, are capable of having that discussion. And yet the media, they so want to shut down a discourse. And so that's one example of when somebody does have a critique that maybe is a little bit beyond what you usually hear on TV, there's a resistance to it. The other thing to point out, Sonali, as regards the debate, was you're talking about people in the crowd yelling things, and that was true. What I was struck by were the times when individual candidates grilled other candidates. And the most remarkable one, I thought, was Jay Inslee on climate change. And he was talking to Joe Biden, and Joe Biden was saying, oh, I've got a climate plan and stuff like that. And Inslee was like, no, your plan isn't good. And Biden said, well, I disagree with that. And then Inslee really went hard at him on specifics and the number of years we have to address issues. And frankly, I would dare say if Jay Inslee doesn't make it as a presidential candidate, he'd be a good debate moderator.
Right. And Tulsi Gabbard challenged Kamala Harris on her record on criminal justice while she was California's attorney general. Ooh, Harris did not like that. And Harris was a very formidable debater, of course. I mean, she's a prosecutor. She knows how to handle herself in a format like this. And in the last debate, she was sort of declared winner when she challenged, very rightly, I think, Joe Biden on his background of supporting segregation by opposing busing. But this time round, she seemed to be in the defensive position.
Yes, and there's a reason for that. I think it's actually a similar situation between the two debates. I do not believe that in the first debate that Joe Biden anticipated that he would be challenged by Kamala Harris. I think he thought some other people on that stage might, but he didn't think that they would do it with such effectiveness and frankly, such standing, you know, have in Harris's case, to have a personal story that was so powerful. And so I think that threw Biden way off his game and Harris got high marks for a very effective challenge. But a similar thing happened to her in the second debate this week. And that is, I don't think she expected Tulsi Gabbard to be the person to come after her and really rip in with, frankly, a lot of detail. That was a prepared challenge to Harris. And now, I think Harris expected that.
Let's talk about Biden, because, of course, Biden has been the front runner. He's been polling high. I suspect that a lot of Democrats who are polled, you know, pick Biden, not because they like him, believe what he says, or even see him necessarily as a stand-in for Obama. They simply pick him because they believe that he is capable of beating Trump. Biden took a total beating in the first debate and, in my opinion, in the second debate as well. He couldn't even get right the advertisement for his own campaign in the closing statement. He said, go to Joe 30330 for, you know, it was embarrassing. And this is the guy that people think are going to beat Trump, or a majority of Democrats think are going to beat Trump. Do you expect his poll numbers to fall dramatically? Because when I look at the media coverage the day after debate, I feel like I saw a very different debate from what a lot of media pundits saw.
You didn't see a different debate. You saw it with clarity. The challenge, of course, is that, as I said before, I think sometimes many of our analysts refuse to see what they've seen. They refuse to acknowledge what's actually occurred. And that's not all of them. Some do a good job, but many don't. And here's the reality. Joe Biden did take hits. And where he took hits was on specificity, where people said, you know, hey, you're saying this, but your plan doesn't say that. Or you've got a plan, but I'm not even sure you really know what your plan is. And these were very effective challenges. Again, I think Cory Booker and a number of turns really effectively challenged Joe Biden on criminal justice issues, a host of other matters. Biden was prepared in that case to push back on some things in Cory Booker's history. But I don't think anybody would suggest that Biden got the better end of that back and forth. And again and again and again in this debate, Biden did not dominate. He didn't show that focus, that skill, that clarity that you saw from both Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren in the first debate. Unfortunately, this is what I'm going to suggest to you. At this point, because the second debate saw, you know, such a clash between Gabbard and Harris and some other issues come into play, and because, frankly, Sanders and Warren did so well in the first debate, I'm going to be intrigued to see how things move here. My bet is that Biden will hold his lead, and I will predict, and again, most dangerous game in the world and not one I really like, but I will predict that Warren has a real bump, you know, that, you know, she's kind of been edging into a second place position in some polls. And my suspicion is that these two nights will end up being quite good for her. As for Harris, I'm not sure that she'll go up, you know, and for a variety of reasons, if Bernie Sanders stays roughly where he's at, maybe goes up a little bit, because I think he did have a very strong performance. If Harris stays roughly where she's at, if Warren goes up a bit, there's still an awfully lot of space for Joe Biden to kind of sit on his numbers. And so I do think that we won't see a dramatic shift, a radical shift, until we've got all these people on the same stage and you really have them clashing. Because that's the point at which voters, grassroots Democrats and independents, will be able to make some real comparisons.
Right. Right. It would be wonderful to actually see the top four front runners debate one another. And over the next few months, the massive field of 20 will certainly get narrowed down either by people stepping down or just not making the cut for future debates. I thought Warren's strongest line, and this seemed to me to really be a theme to challenge the entire Democratic Party, was when she said to Congressman John Delaney, why run for president just to say what we really can't do and shouldn't fight for? And that got such huge applause. And Democrats have been constantly beaten by their or accused by their base of just being spineless and not standing up for their vision and not standing up to their ideals. Whereas Republicans, you know, just say what they want and go out and fight tooth and nail for it and win it by the skin of their teeth using all sorts of unethical means to get it. But Democrats just roll over. And it was remarkable to me that you had still so many moderates, so-called moderates, reformists, who just wanted to keep the party on this straight and narrow and this very weak position, as if, you know, because that didn't work for Hillary Clinton. It didn't work for John Kerry. It didn't work for so many other so-called moderate Democrats.
Yeah. Well, that's where it gets. And I'm really glad you focused on that, because it really gets to the heart of this challenge. We started out talking about it a little bit. There's been such a tendency in the Democratic Party to shut down and to shut out progressive change messengers. And as a result, that's caused the party to look, I think, in the eyes of an awfully lot of voters, including many of its own supporters, as a managerial party. And that means when the Democrats come to power, they will manage what they are given. They may manage it much better than the Republicans, and they may even make some improvements, but they're not going to radically change it. And that, at this point in our history, that's not an effective message. There may have been points in our history where being the managerial party was effective and it did work. I think sometimes it does work after a period of a lot of intensity and where people are sort of worn out and they just want somebody to kind of be in charge. That's what Eisenhower did in many ways in the 50s. But as a Republican, I'll point out. But where we're at right now is we're 30 years into a globalization revolution that is changing everything about how we relate to the rest of the world. We're 20 years into a digital revolution that is changing everything about how we communicate with one another and in business, in organizing, all sorts of other things. This digital revolution, hugely transforming. And now we're 8 to 10 years into an automation revolution that is and will change everything about how we work and really how we organize our lives. And with all of this coming at people, on top of all of our unresolved economic, social, and racial justice challenges in our society, and climate change, right? It's got a lot spinning all at once. This is a very demanding moment. And to simply come in and say you're going to manage things doesn't sound very attractive. And yet, we have these people who, you know, basically want to say no. And I think the reason that Elizabeth Warren got such a thunderous round of applause for that, why it really was the takeaway line of the two nights of debates, is because it resonated. It made such total sense. And I think there are many grassroots Democrats and independents who are horrified by the notion that after you go through the hell of Donald Trump, you might kind of only get back to the status quo that existed before Donald Trump became president. And that's not a particularly appealing notion.
Right. I mean, there's these competing notions about, well, just get somebody who can beat Trump because he's so dangerous versus, this is actually the appropriate time to demand transformational change. There's a lot of people, unfortunately, who fear that asking for transformational change now will just end up leaving us in Trump's hands for another 4 years. How to convince those people who are voting more out of fear than out of vision that this is the right moment. It's just that to me is such a big question here. And it goes back to how close Bernie Sanders came in 2016 to winning the Democratic nomination, which perhaps was that make or break moment when our country could have gone one of two ways. And instead, with Hillary Clinton as the nominee, went down the worst possible path. I don't know the question, answer to that question.
Well, but you're putting a lot of important ideas on the table, and that's why I love talking to you. And here's one thing that I'll suggest to you. The future is never written completely. If we miss an opportunity, we have another chance to do it. And so we should never lose sight of the fact that if you didn't get what you wanted in 2016, it is completely reasonable to ask for it in 2020. Not denying the fear that people have as regards Donald Trump, not denying the need to address the high crimes and misdemeanors of his presidency, but recognizing also that, you know, we live on many tracks, and one of the tracks we live on is the one where we say we would like a better life. We would like to solve some problems. And so getting rid of Trump is one thing because he's taking us backwards, making things worse. But it is still completely reasonable to say, well, we'd like to do that, and then we'd like to go forward. And I think one of the best ways to challenge it is with history. And I'll just tell you, I'm finishing a book on this transition period in the 1940s after the end of the Roosevelt presidency. And what I can really strongly emphasize is that there were people in the Democratic Party in 1944, 1945, 1946, who wanted to come out of World War II and address racism and sexism at home. They said it explicitly. If you read these speeches, they blow your mind. They were literally saying, you know, we've had women working. Let's bring them fully into society. Let's realize all their rights. We've had African Americans fighting our wars overseas. We can't make them go home to segregation. And it was really this remarkable message. And they were only narrowly defeated. They came close to winning at conventions and in all sorts of battles in that time. And all I want to emphasize is that when you look at it now, you say, how much better off we would have been if in the late 1940s after World War II, we had really as a country tried to tackle racism, sexism, all sorts of other challenges, rather than kind of going into that 1950s of, well, you know, we're just going to kind of relax. And so I think we cannot afford to miss opportunities. And if we don't get what we want in one election, we should demand it in the next.
Finally, John, eventually one of the top four is most likely, four front runners most likely going to end up matched up against Trump: Kamala Harris, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, or Elizabeth Warren. As progressives, of course, most of us hope it's either Bernie Sanders, if not him, Elizabeth Warren. But of the four, I feel like Biden is the least capable of actually surviving Trump's, you know, cutthroat attacks. Harris is capable of fending them off, but has a history, right? He can call her out the way Tulsi Gabbard called her out about her criminal justice issues. But Warren and Sanders seem most immune to Trump's attacks, because what is he going to attack them for? Wanting, you know, too much for ordinary Americans, wanting Medicare for all. If he goes down that path, they could win. It feels like those two would be the best poised to take him on.
Well, who knows? Some people looked at the picture of the two of them at the end of the debate where they embraced and thought, wow, that sort of looks like a pretty good ticket.
Yep.
But here's the one thing I'll emphasize to you. Donald Trump is a master at making his opponent into what he wants his opponent to be. And so rest assured, if it was, you know, Sanders or Warren, Donald Trump would have his attack. And he would scream socialist, 90% taxes. Right. He would say horrible things about Warren, as he has many times in the past. And so the key is not that Donald Trump, you know, wouldn't have logical things to attack them on, because he would attack them on illogical things. That's a given. What you need, this is the most important thing. The Democrats must nominate someone who is confident in who they are and who, if attacked, will say, yes, I'm glad to talk about that, and then do it. And so if you attack Bernie Sanders as a socialist, he says, yes, I'm a socialist. And that is so disarming. And I really want to emphasize that in too many cases, too often, Democrats have nominated people who literally are afraid even to be called liberals, and are afraid to be seen as populist champions of the great mass of people. And so what I would, my only counsel, my only suggestion is nominate somebody who's really confident, who knows who they are and is ready to stand there. And, you know, expect the attacks from Donald Trump, but have someone who, when attacked, says, yeah, so what? Let's talk about this, and really moves it forward. That was what Hillary Clinton, unfortunately, was not particularly good at. And frankly, I have to tell you, after watching several debates, I'm not sure that Joe Biden's very good at that.
Well, he's not even good at giving out his own campaign website. John, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a great pleasure to be with you.
Appreciate it. My guest has been John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine, host of their new podcast, Next Left, featuring interviews with rising progressive politicians who explain how they plan to change the country. We've been discussing the Democratic candidate debates from this week. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.